Omaha Public Radio presents another program from FilmStreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema, on Noon Forum. In a special program for National Child Abuse Awareness Month, co-sponsored by Project Harmony, we'll hear a question-and-answer session which followed a special screening of the 2002 film Antoine Fisher, directed by Denzel Washington. The guest will be the man whose name the film bears, Hollywood screenwriter, director, and film producer Antoine Fisher. The film tells the story of a sailor in the United States Navy who is prone to violent outbursts and is sent to a naval psychiatrist for help. Refusing at first to open up, the young man eventually breaks down and reveals a horrific childhood. Through the guidance of his doctor, he confronts his painful past and begins a quest to find the family he never knew. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 10, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of FilmStreams, Project Harmony, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gene Klein, Executive Director of Project Harmony.
We're going to treat this very informal. We do have two microphones that we can bring up to you. This is Antoine Fisher, as if you need an introduction.
Hello.
And as I said earlier, we didn't script any questions, or if there's... Antoine was just really cool about it and said, ask away, and I'll do my best to answer. So we'll just turn the microphone over to him, and if anyone wants or has a question, just start raising your hand, and we'll make sure that you get a microphone. Okay, we'll start right here. We'll get to you, Jane.
What part of the movie was fictional?
You know, it's a movie, so it's a true story. But if we were to lay my story out, how it actually happened, we would still be making the movie. You have to take out the things that people would not want to see or wouldn't make sense to put in the movie. Sometimes you have to even make a character, invent a character to help you get to the point you're trying to make. Because to have, for example, in my movie, my teacher, her name was Mrs. Prophet. In the book, I wrote about her, and I spent a whole chapter talking about her. The therapist, which Denzel plays, I talk about him for a paragraph. But in the movie, he's in the whole movie, and my teacher is not in the movie. She's in the movie. She's a character in the movie. She played in the movie. But she's... So you have to, when it's a movie, you have to make it movie-like. It's all true, but you have to pin it together so it'll make sense. Oh, yeah, that happens. Molested, everything. All that is true. And even more happened than that, you know. But some of the, this movie, they had to take a lot of it out when we first did it. There was a lot of abuse that was in there, and the studio wanted to get a PG-13 so younger people could see the movie, because they had graded it to be restricted. And so even the organization that rates movies still said it should have been restricted, but they felt also that it would be a benefit for younger people to be able to see. So, yeah.
The young man who played you in the movie was wonderful. How did you choose him?
Where is she? Oh. Well, I didn't actually choose him. Denzel chose him. But I knew him. He worked at the store at the... on the Sony Picture Studio lot. And so I had known him for years, and he had acted in some television shows and some music videos. He was an actor. The thing about the movie studios in Hollywood, if, you know, a lot of people who want to work in the movie industry, one way to get in is to get a job on the studio lot. So it wasn't as magical as it sounds, you know. Like, when I was a guard at Sony, I was a security guard there. I didn't go there to become a writer. I was trying to get away from the job I had had as a prison guard. But all the other security guards there had been to film school. So, you know, the studios have walls around it, and they hire people to keep people out of the lot. So the only way to get into the lot is get a job. So that's what Derek did, and, you know, he got an audition, and he did well. African-American actor of his build and type had auditioned for it, like Mekhi Phifer and Omar Epps and everybody. But nobody would cry. Derek could cry. And so that's what got him the role. He was able to cry.
When you were doing the actual filming, what role did you have? How did you interact during the filming process?
Well, I was there every day, and you know, when you're making a film, I wrote the film. Sometimes when you get out on the set, you realize you can't do what you had written, so you have to rewrite the whole scene again. So that's what I was doing, and being a technical advisor, and because we did the film at the locations where I had grown up, and some of the people who were in the movie were encouraged to be in the movie by me, and the studio and Denzel and the producer felt like I should stay with the film all the way through. So I was there every day.
So did things escalate with the Cheryl character, and did you marry her?
No. You know, people, you know, that's the number one question. Number one question that I married Cheryl, and then, or how's the relationship with my mother and me? Those are two questions. Well, Cheryl wasn't as special to me as she is in this movie. But she was a real person, is what I was trying to explain. Sometimes they're real characters, but you have to, like, in the book I wrote, Finding Fish, there are three girls that were significant in my growing up, and Cheryl was one of them. But you can't have them in the movie because I'm shy in the movie, and I look like a playboy, right? So I married my wife, and I met my wife on the Sony Pictures studio lot. And one day I was there taking a meeting, and then I saw her walking. And at the end of the year, this was like in February, and then we got married right before Christmas. And we've been married for 12 years, and we have two kids. But Cheryl was a friend, someone that I learned that I could talk to when I was stationed in Hawaii. And so we would meet to talk. It was, that was pretty special, but it wasn't anything other than that. We were kind of two kids who had difficult time growing up and just found each other and used each other to get through the time. You had a time, man.
Yeah. I'm here.
Where are you?
Right here.
Oh, okay.
Short guy in the front.
Yeah.
You said Mrs. Prophet was a teacher.
Yes.
Yeah. And is that secondary education? I wondered about the education, like when you were with the Tates, did you get to go to school every day and on that?
Oh, yeah.
Public school in Cleveland.
Public school. And, you know, when I was growing up, wasn't that long ago, it seemed like, but apparently it was. Everybody went to school, and school was like a part, it was like church, a part of our lives, you know. And we would walk to school, and I found school to be a place where I could get relief. And lucky for me, I had a teacher who was really, she was more like a mother. In fact, I still know her. She's like the grandmother to my kids. I was in her class for the 4th, 5th, and 6th grade. So she really got to know me. She had the same students for all three grades, which really made a difference in all of our lives. And I think because of those 3 years, we all are really, really, I think, closer than most students that went to school together. So we know each other, those of us who are still alive. And she was the reason for that. She created a family in her classroom with the children she had. And as a result of the way she treated us, and we never wanted to part from each other. And so, and from her either. I threw a big party in Cleveland. I came to Cleveland and found as many of my classmates as I could that was in the class. And it was a really nice get-together, and I got the bright idea, of course, Ms. Prophet wasn't going to come. So I called her, and she was so surprised. It was like, as I think about my life and the times you can conjure up that really meant a lot to you, that evening was a really great time. Ms. Prophet, yeah, teachers, saviors,
great teacher.
You know.
Antoine.
Yes.
In the film, it said your mom said that you were the oldest sibling. Did you ever find your siblings, and do you still have a relationship with them?
Oh, let's see. I met my mother, and she told me that she had other children. With my father, there was only me, and I never knew of my mother or any other children or her life. But when I met her, she told me that she had four other children, five, and they were all in foster care and all the whole thing, had similar lives to my own. And as far as sometimes life doesn't work out in the magical way, so it seems like we tried, but it seems like we were just strangers, you know, who had to get to know each other. And then with like strangers, you have to discover something you have in common. And then if you don't find anything that you have in common, then it gets difficult to be around or talk on the phone, and then you just drift away. I've come to realize, for me, family is like where you find it. Sometimes friends can make a better family member than people who are your actual family member. And you probably could trust them more.
Did you really have a friend that died? I mean, got killed in the store?
Yes. That was true also.
I mean, like, after you got whooped and stuff, did you run to his house? Were you friends with him because you didn't want to get beat up? Because in the movie, he said he was friends with him because...
That was a part of my strategy to keep him from jumping on me, right? To be his friend. Yeah, and he was in those days, he was like, you know, I was homeless when I came back, and he let me stay at his house. So, and then he got killed. And so we had grown up together. So he, you know, I don't know. It's a tricky question. Yes.
Do you still have a relationship with your dad's family?
You know, I had a relationship with my... He asked me, do I still have a relationship with my dad's family? And yes, I had a better relationship with them than with my mother's family. My mother's older brother, I have a good relationship with him. And I talk to him almost every week on the phone. My father's family, they were older people. So when I met them, you know, there were 10 uncles and aunts. Now there's only one left. So I met them just in time. But they were a really like a beautiful family and really warm. They didn't know about me because my mother, she had me in prison. And in those days, I guess the privacy of my mother was important. So it was kind of private, I suppose. Yes.
Have you learned to forgive the Tates, or do you still hold on to that anger?
That's the third popular question. You know, their real name was Pack. You know, when I think about them, I think about forgiveness, I always think about what forgiveness means to me and what it would mean for them. I think I had enough trouble trying to straighten things out rather than going out trying to do something for someone else, I had a lot of issues to work out on my own. It's almost like having a broken leg trying to rescue somebody else. I need to take care of myself. So I thought forgiveness is something you do for yourself, because if you can find a way to get past all of that, then that what people understand as forgiveness will come more naturally. It's not that you could do anything for them. If I hit you in the eye and then before you could grab your eye, you said, "Oh, wow, you hit me in the eye." And then I say, "Oh, forgive me. You have to forgive me." And then you say, "Well, okay, since you ask and I'm a good Christian, I'm going to forgive you." And then you walk away with this fat eye. And every time you see, look in the mirror, you're thinking like, "Wow, a guy hit me in the eye." And I get to feel like, "Oh, everything is cool because he forgave me." Right. So then I call you up with your fat eye and say, "Hey, let's go to the movies." And you say, "Well, I can't see out of one eye." So it's hard, you know. It would have been enough that I hit you in the eye. Rather than asking you for something, I should, you know, forgiveness, I should ask you, is there anything I can do for you? Rather than do something for me, forgive me. Why wouldn't I say, can I do anything to make this right? I apologize. And if there's anything I can do, let me know. And I hope you can get past what I've done to you. Then that's a good beginning. You know, the people who hurt people always want forgiveness, what we understand as forgiveness. But I think if you hurt somebody, you should be prepared to do something for them to try to ease their situation. I think it's really clever for someone to hurt you and say, "Hey, forgive me."
And then how old are you now?
Yes?
How old are you now?
I'm 49. I'll be 50 this year. Yes.
I was wondering how Denzel got involved with the project, or how he first heard about your story and how that came together.
When I was a guard on the Sony lot, Denzel's office was on the lot. I was a guard at that lot for like 3 months, but I got to know a lot of people. I didn't know Denzel, but I knew his niece because she worked for him. And on a lot like that, you know, you see everybody. It's like Disneyland. You see Danny DeVito, you see Sidney Poitier, everybody's walking around, you know. And when I found my family, I actually found my family after I got out of the Navy. That's another thing. Because for the movie, I wrote it that way, because if I told the story how it actually happened, then all the people who were in the movie couldn't be in the movie anymore, because I would have gotten out of the Navy. So you have to have more people, and that costs more money. So for the movie, I found them while I was in the Navy. So I found them while I was actually working at Sony as a security guard. And when I went to go meet them, I came back. I told Rita, which is Denzel's niece, that I found my family. And I told her I was going to write a screenplay about it. And so when I wrote it, I let her read it. And then she let Pauletta read it, Denzel's wife. And then eventually Denzel read it. That's how it happened.
Did you intend to have your book turned into a movie?
I actually wrote the movie first. The reason why I wrote the book, because it was taking them so long to make the movie. It took them 9 years to make the movie. I wrote the movie in 1992, and they didn't make it till, I think, 2001, something like that. Yeah.
Once things started moving and the movie started getting made, did you ever have second thoughts about sharing all those intimate details of your
life? Oh, yeah, even when I was writing it. I remember when I finished writing the first draft of it, I thought, like, wow. I always say, like, wow. Mm-hmm. But I thought, wow. But then I thought, well, I did all of this and they're expecting it now, so I just mailed it and tried not to think about it. And then after that, I had written 41 extra drafts of it before the studio bought it. So I wrote my story 41 times before the studio bought it. And then after they bought it, they made me continue to write it over the course of 9 years. So I must have written over 150 versions and drafts of my story, which is not that unusual. Sometimes some people think that you can write a screenplay and then you give it to the studio and then they give you a couple of notes and then you're off. When you're first starting, it's hard, and you're younger. I think as I've gotten older, I've become a better writer, and there's some things that I've learned instinctively to do now that I've been doing it for 17 years now that I didn't know then. So that was the price of learning how to write a screenplay, which I was happy to do. It gave me the life that I have now. And besides, a lot of people were sticking their neck out for me. I didn't want to let them down. And in my growing up, I didn't meet a lot of people who were extending themselves, you know, opportunity to me. And so I did learn while I was in the Navy that if someone is trying to help you, you know, you should, no matter how you feel or whether you like them or not, you have to, and you know it's right what they're doing, you have to do right. So I decided that I was going to write my story until they tell me to stop.
Why didn't you play yourself in the movie?
Acting's for crazy people. I'm not crazy.
You couldn't hear me?
Yes. Yes. Hey.
Yeah, why didn't you play yourself in the movie?
Believe it or not, I have no desire to be an actor. Actors are crazy. All of them. You know, you have to be crazy. You know, and they get in these characters and it's hard for them to get out of them. Can you imagine Denzel getting out of Training Day? He had to go stay at a hotel until it was over. You know, people, some, you know, they get them, you know, the really good actors, I guess they call it method acting. They become the character. And so when you come home, it's just like, you know, you come home from filming and then you've been playing Alonzo Harris all day and then your wife says, hey, can you go in the refrigerator and give me the butter? And you just get off the set of Training Day and you got to go back tomorrow? Yeah, so, you know, and comedians, sometimes I found it in where I work out there, they seem to be the saddest people of all the people who work in film. Some of them, a lot of them, seem to have, and they've been funny their entire lives, and they found a way to relieve their pain sometime through comedy when they were children. And then some of them wind up in Hollywood still having worked out their issues, and, you know.
But you wouldn't have been acting. You'd have just been playing yourself.
Once is enough, man. You want me to keep acting in movies? I don't like acting. I like writing. Writing is good.
Antoine, right back here.
Okay.
What made you want to share your story in making a movie? What was your inspiration in doing it in that manner?
In the beginning, I didn't plan to, because I didn't go to Sony to... I was a prison guard. When I got out of the Navy, I went to the Federal Law Enforcement Academy, and I was a prison guard at a prison called Terminal Island, and it was terrible. And I felt like I was in prison. Some of those days, you know, they make you stay for 16 hours. I didn't like it. So I heard Sony was hiring security guards, so I went there, and they hired me. But, you know, while I was there, it's such a creative place, and there's so many people who are inspiring people. And then when I found my family and people were suggesting that it would make for a good film, it didn't dawn on me that I would be disclosing my secrets. I just thought of it as, oh, maybe I should do it. And then once you start writing it, traveling on the memories of your life, and you run into this, oh, wow, okay, I remember that. And then you know, you go through your life and you start finding these things that you didn't really forget, but you never really confronted anymore. And it was kind of cathartic for me. And in healing, in a way, not really healing, but it was soothing in a way to write about it. And so when I was done, then I had an entire screenplay. So it was kind of accidental, but then I benefited in a lot of ways from doing it.
Have you written any other screenplays or books?
Oh, yeah. I've been a screenwriter and working in Los Angeles for 17 years. And some movies I know you've seen before. And my name is not on all of them. Like this movie, Money Talks, with Chris Tucker and Charlie Sheen. I rewrote that movie, Rush Hour, the first Rush Hour. I worked on some other movies, a lot of movies. Over these years, it's all I've done is write movies. And they call it script doctoring. Like if one writer is good at action or comedy and another writer might be good at dialogue, so they would, for me, I'm seen as somebody who's good at writing dialogue. So I'm not good at writing action sequences where cars run, drive down the street and turn and all that kind of stuff. So so this person may have written the screenplay, but the dialogue is not good. So they give the screenplay to me to fix the dialogue. Then they may give it to someone else to fix the action. So that's why sometimes when you see movies, they have more than one writer on it, on the film.
Okay. I have one over here. I'm just wondering, you mentioned that the psychiatrist in your book only has a paragraph. Was your on-screen relationship in real life the same with your psychiatrist, or was that a Hollywood version?
No, it was the same. It's just that, you know, when you decide to write a story, you have to decide what's the best way to tell it. You have to decide a lot of things. You have to decide, for in my case, if even though I felt that my teacher had did more for me as I remember my life, it makes more sense to use the psychiatrist because he did a lot for me too. But ours was a relationship where we talked back and forth, which makes a perfect situation for a movie. And so to reveal my story to him, if I had used my teacher, I would not have been able to show myself any older than I was in sixth grade. Yeah.
Mr. Fisher.
Yeah.
Which films that you've worked on have been your favorite? Are there any?
Antoine Fisher.
Besides that.
I got my own theme song after it. Yeah. No. Well, let's see. Well, I've written some screenplays that haven't gotten made, and some that I really like. I just directed a short film that I wrote and I directed and I really enjoy. It's a drama. I like Training Day too, which I just finished. You know, it always seems to be the last couple things I've done.
Can you share what part of the movie was the most difficult to see it on film?
Abuse. The day that Malcolm Kelly and I forget the other kid's name, they were tied up in the basement or in the molestation. You know, because I feel, you know, it's for people, who, I guess you can only imagine if you haven't been molested before. And no matter how old you get, it never like goes away. It's like your memories. Like if this building is built from bricks, you know, and the bricks represent memories, just like the happy memories, you don't want to take them out of the building because the building will fall down because you have so many. Even if you don't have that many unhappy memories, you can't take those bricks out either because the building may fall down. So all of your life is important, the good and the bad. So you can't run from the unhappy things that have happened to you, just like you may want to remember the fond memories that you have because it's all your life. You know, some people don't know why they behave the way they do. sometimes if they would reflect on their life, they may be able to figure it out, or they may have an opportunity to go and talk to someone, which I really believe is something that we all should do, talk to a professional. I think that, a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I think, you know, when people hurt themselves, like if you were to fall and chip your tooth, or if you broke your leg, stepped off a curb and hurt your ankle, you go to the doctor right away because you wouldn't want to live with the pain. You wouldn't want to limp for the rest of your life. Or you wouldn't want to have a conversation with someone and have them look at your teeth and they're not right. So you have dental health and you have physical health. You know, you have to maintain that. You also have mental health. You know, when you have a friend that hurts your feelings, or your best friend is murdered, or your father dies or your mother dies, or your sister doesn't seem to love you, or your mother or father, or you've been abandoned, or someone just hurts your feelings. That's just like being, getting a scar. And, this stuff, it is a real thing. So, you know, even though it's not something that you can see, like a broken arm, people can see it in your behavior. Especially, you know, if you have a lot that you have mounted over the years. And I think sometimes people never, they're too ashamed to go and say, I need to talk to someone about some of the things that have happened to me in my life. A lot of people feel like they can handle it, and they feel like they're managing their lives well. But, you know, when you think about yourself, a lot of times you're not how you appear to other people. You may go and buy yourself something nice to put on, and you may, you know, have the latest car that everybody, you know, is like raving over. But when you step out and people get a chance to look at your eyes and see your behavior, they may see that tells a different story. And, you know, this is real life. Just like people get murdered, like my friend was killed, that was real. I had never seen anything like that before. And we had been friends since we were small. And in just a moment, he's gone. And there's nothing you can say, nothing you can do, no one you can talk to change it. It's done. And it's not good. So you have to really manage your life and be honest with yourself and invite people. You can't sometimes have your friend to talk to because they'll tell somebody else. So that's why I stick with a professional, somebody you can sue.
How do you feel about foster care now, and what advice would you give a kid that's in foster care that's being treated well?
I think, you know, foster care is a really good thing. I think, you know, they probably need more, you know, good foster parents, and because there's a lot of kids, sometimes, unfortunately, you know, sometimes in an emergency situation, they need people who they can trust and who will take care of the kid until they straighten out their parents' situation. You know, I think social services, you know, they depend on the community to help them. Social service can't do everything by themselves. They need the community to help, and they need good foster parents. And places like Project Harmony, it's another good. It's like a community of people and organizations that help and would help. And for kids who are in foster care in a good home, just behave. I mean, you got to understand, and kids too. And some kids, you know, when they come to your house, you never know what they've been through. Sometimes some kids know more, or they've been through more than you have, and you look at them and they're just kids, and you think that, well, all this kid needs is love, so I'm going to love this kid. And they're not like showing you love in return. In fact, they're giving you misery, and you may not know the whole story. So sometimes when you're a foster parent, you have to like go eat some Cheerios, get yourself together and get ready, and you never know what it might what it might be. You got to hang in there. If you say, you know, as long as you can, I don't think, you know, everybody who's in foster care is easy to have in your house.
And Antoine, you mentioned your relationship with your teacher.
Yes.
And that you had her for three grades. Was there ever a period of time in that 3 years when she was your teacher that you felt like you had an opportunity to tell her or somebody in that position about the abuse you were suffering?
No. The way I grew up, you know, when I grew up, the abuse was always happening. It was like always happening. It did not just start like when I felt, I don't know when I started coming into the knowledge of myself, but whenever I did, it was going on. And I did not know that other kids weren't being treated the same way because my foster brother and sister were treated the same way as well. So it was going out into the neighborhood and discovering that, oh, maybe this is not normal. And then I was ashamed of things. And I was afraid. And my teacher, to me, wasn't as powerful as my foster mother. My social workers weren't either. So, you know, people ask women and even men who are abused by their spouse, why don't you just leave? Why don't you just tell somebody? That's an easy question to pose to somebody when you haven't been in that situation to be able to understand the fear or the low self-esteem that may make you feel like if you leave this person, where will you go? You know, my foster mother was right about one thing is that it appeared that nobody wanted me because I did wind up sleeping in storefronts. I was homeless even into the winter in Cleveland. And it appeared that nobody wanted me. They told me, the social worker said, no one wanted to take in a teenage boy, so they put me in reform school where I stayed until I graduated. And then that's when another chapter of difficulties began, you know. But I made it anyway. Yes?
Antoine, are you writing poetry?
I haven't in a while. I haven't written poetry in a while. I'm painting watercolors and acrylic. I like that. It kind of serves the same purpose as writing poetry did for me. I didn't write poetry because I felt like an artist or anything. It was like kind of a relief, which I think like writing for young people, keeping journals and things like that might be a good idea. Then you can almost explain yourself to yourself. You know, when you write the way you feel, and if you come back like a month later and read it again, I think it would be interesting, you know, for like you guys, young people to write, even write a screenplay or a short story. I think it's therapeutic.
What's the book that you're just finishing?
It's called A Boy Should Know How to Tie a Tie. I came up with this idea because when I was in boot camp, we didn't wear the Cracker Jack style uniform. We wore a Admiral style uniform with a necktie. And they were teaching us all how to tie a tie, those of us who didn't know how, which I didn't know how to tie a tie. And for the life of me, I couldn't tie it. And they were explaining it to me and stand in front of me. So they had me, made me go in the shower and made me tie the tie in the shower in boot camp. And I was thinking about my foster father. He was a preacher, a minister, and he wore a tie all the time. I used to watch him tie it, and he'd do it so fast. You know, it was almost like a magic trick growing up, watching him do it. And on his closet, behind his closet door, he had like hundreds of ties. All colors, you know. And I kept thinking, he should have taught me how to tie a tie in all those years. So I thought about that and decided to write this book. It's kind of an etiquette book for boys, but there's more than that because it's stories about me and making choices, which I found out Well, I realized that as I was on my own going through the life I had had, I was making choices every day, and I was making good choices. And even when I made the wrong choice, at some point I realized that when you make wrong choices, you have to suffer through to get back on the right track. And sometimes that's what is the downfall of some, especially young people who don't want to ever suffer, or they think life is supposed to be fair all the time. I guess fair is just a matter of the way you look at things, because some lessons you only learn through, you know, some lessons you can only learn best through going through some difficulty or pain. So you can't run from everything that's painful and hard. So you have to, I found that you have to just remember that and remember what you learned from it.
Maybe time for one or two more questions. So,
hi, I was wondering if some people have approached you and let you know that your movie or book has helped them, and if so, what was the most touching story for you?
Oh, I get letters from everywhere, even not just in America, in Canada, and just everywhere, Australia, England, Italy. That movie touched a lot of people, and people who had let their children go and found them again because they wanted to, or children who decided to look for their parents, that kind of thing. And even people who, I remember I get this letter, email from this woman. She said she was 75 years old, and she saw the movie, and she wanted to write a book about her growing up in an abusive home. And I was thinking, of course, you know, she's older now. She's been an adult on her own and have had power over her own life for a long time. But the things that happened to her as a child, she still remembers, and it still causes her pain. And to write about it probably is a good idea. So, you know, when I, those kinds of stories, and, you know, some people want to become social workers. You know, that the book I wrote, the Navy and the Air Force and the Marine Corps uses it in boot camp as a part of the teaching. Universities like UCLA and University of Michigan, a lot of colleges use it in the social science. So that I feel like even though I was ashamed of a lot of what happened to me, none of it was my fault, but I can see now that, you know, if you have some difficulties, that you can make them make sense to you, and in this way help other people. I think that it probably was a, since I had to suffer anyway and things didn't go right how I wish they would have gone, you know, it all turned out well in the end anyway.
Was it a struggle for you to learn how to be in a relationship, how to trust somebody, how to interact with them? There was nobody around you.
What do you mean, like with women?
Yes, with your family and larger extent, your wife and your
children. Oh, well, I wish they were here to tell you, but I feel like I do all right.
No, wait. My question was, though, not I assume you do all right, but no. How difficult was it for you to learn the nature of relationships and how to be
in
one?
I have to give the U.S. Navy the credit for that, because you know, I was like immersed into a, you know, the Navy, you know, they just toss you all in together, you know, and, you know, some people are from all over the country, you know, from Appalachia and New York City and Los Angeles and Las Vegas and even Omaha. And then you're sleeping in a small room with all these people. You have to learn to get along with them. You know, people who like, I mean, I was sleeping next to this guy who liked country music. I never like country music, you know, Ronnie Millsap and that. I liked Gladys Knight. And so that's how I grew up. But they put this guy, he slept right next door to me, right here by me. There was only a sheet of metal between us. And then they had a big open space there. And then I was listening to Ronnie Millsap. If he got down to the compartment first, he would turn it on. I couldn't turn mine on. That was the rule. So if I got, we were racing down there. He had to listen to Gladys Knight some of them days, right? But after a while, I started liking country music because I was exposed to it. And then I was walking around the ship with not an iPod, but my headphones on and my cassette tape listening to Willie Nelson because I liked more of what he was saying. And I discovered that country music was kind of like soul music. It was all talking about love and broken hearts, the same thing. It's just the way they played the instruments were different and the texture that they used to tell the story, but it was all the same of heartbreak and falling in love, the same thing. So I could appreciate Ronnie Millsap, you know?
Okay.
So it helped.
Anything, Rachel, you want to add at the end here?
I talked to Yolanda Ross yesterday, and she's from Omaha, for those of you that don't know, and she played your cousin. So,
yeah.
I mean, just to give a shout-out to her and a brief mention for her because she's a terrific actress, terrific person, great friend.
Yeah, actually, I talked to her yesterday also. She said, you didn't tell me you were going to Omaha. I forgot she was from Omaha.
Yeah,
Yolanda. She's good. She's a good actor. Yeah, and she contributed a lot. You know, she directed Denzel in this area. So the molestation scene was the part where she was the character who played my cousin that slapped me and, you know, told me to go down in the basement. So she told Denzel, rather than seeing any of that, why don't we just have me do my voice? Because that's a little bit much. She told Denzel that. He said, oh, that's a good idea. Right from Omaha.
You've been listening to a question and answer session on Noon Forum for National Child Abuse Awareness Month, which followed a special screening of the 2002 film Antoine Fisher, directed by Denzel Washington. The event took place at Filmstreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. The guest was the man whose name the film bears, Hollywood screenwriter, director, and film producer Antoine Fisher. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 10, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, Laura Shainrock, and Jim Foyt of Filmstreams, and Ann Weitz of Project Harmony for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.